half ill," she said lightly, amused, turning to him. "You found a genuine Anguissette." He laughed, coming to join us.
"I thought she would approve."
"Hmm." She loosed me, and I nearly fell on the floor. "I've wondered what you were hiding, you magician, you. I know people who've waged a considerable amount of money in speculation." Delaunay wagged one finger back and forth at her.
"We had an agreement, Melisande. Do you want Cousin Augier to know why his son cancelled his wedding at the last moment?"
"Just thinking aloud, sweet man." She gave him the same treatment, a trailing caress down the side of his face. Delaunay merely smiled.
"You must think of me when you decide it's time for her to serve Nama, Anarfiel."
She turned back to me, smiling sweetly. "You do wish to serve Nama, don't you, child?" Her smile made me tremble, and at last I understood what Delaunay had meant. The memory of the Dalwayne's chastiser and the adepts of Mandrake House paled beside the exquisite cruelty etched in that smile. I would like to say that I sensed then the long corridor of history stretching before us, the role I was to play, and the terrible lengths to which it would drive me. But it would be a lie.
I thought nothing of the kind. I thought nothing at all. Instead, I forgot my manners, my long training in the night court, and wallowed in her blue gaze.
"Yes," I whispered in answer, "my lady."
"Good." She turned away again, dismissing me, taking Delaunay's hand and steering him toward the door.
"There is a small matter I wish to discuss with you." This was my introduction to Melisande Charizai, who had a mind as subtle as Delaunay's, and a far colder heart. Chapter 8.
"And here," Delaunay said, pointing, "is the stronghold of Comte Michel de Ferreau, who commands 600 men and holds the border at Longview Pass."
History, politics, geography, the lessons were unending. In accordance with the diaspora of the Companions, the land of Terre d'Ange is divided into 7 provinces, and the king, or betimes the queen, rules from the city in reverent memory of Blessed Eloa. Gentle Aisheth went to the southern coastal lands, which hold dreamers and sailors, healers and traders, as well as the thousand birds and wild cavaliers of the salt marshes. Her province is called Isande, and it is the smallest of the 7. There are Tsingani who dwell there and live unmolested. Also to the south went Shemhazai, westerly to the mountainous borders of Aragonia, with whom our long peace still stands. Siobhal is the name of this province, and it is a prosperous one, with a great tradition for learning, for Shemhazai ever treasured knowledge. Inland to the north of Siobhal is Lanyas, the grape-rich province of Anil, who is betimes called the Star of Love. Alongside it, on the rocky coast, is the province of Cushit, where Cushiel made his home, all the way up to the Point d'Ouest. It is a harsh land, like its namesake. Further northward is Arzal, which clings along the coast, close enough at one point to see the white cliffs of Alba. Were it not for the fact that the Master of the Straits controls the waters that lie between us, indeed, there might be danger of a powerful alliance between Arzal and Alba. Of this I took note, for Trevelyan is the ruling duchy of Arzal, and my heart still beat faster to remember Baudouin de Trevelyan's kiss. Beneath the province of Arzal is Namar, where Nama dwelt, and it is a place of many rivers, very beautiful and fruitful. There is a shrine where the river Nama arises from beneath the earth, and all her servants make a pilgrimage there within their lifetimes. To the east, bordering the Skaldic territories, lies the long, narrow province of Cumlach, where Marshal Carmiel made his home and founded the first armies of those bright, fierce d'Angeline troops who have for so long defended the nation from invasion. This, I learned from Delaunay, is the nature of my homeland
and the division of power within it. Slowly I came to an understanding of these divisions and the implication of power that each province held its own, each reflecting to some degree the nature of their angelic founders. Carsiel alone among Elawa's companions took no province for his own, but remained faithful at his wandering lord's side. He had but one namesake in the land, the Carseline Brotherhood, an order of priests who swear allegiance to the precepts of Carsiel. It is a service as rigorous as that of Narmar's, and far sterner, which is perhaps why it is no longer popular. Only the oldest of provincial nobles maintain the tradition, passed within the family from generation to generation, of pledging a younger son to the Carseline Brotherhood. Like us, they become fosterlings at the age of 10, but it is a harsh and ascetic life of training at arms, celibacy, and denial. You see, Fedra, why Cumlach has always held the greatest strategic importance. Delaunay's finger traced its borderline on a map. I glanced up into his questioning eyes and sighed. Yes, my lord. Good. His finger moved back up, hovering. He had beautiful hands, with long, tapering fingers. Here, see, is where the fighting has been. He indicated a dense patch of mountainous terrain. You marked what the iron trader was saying last night. The Skuldi have been threatening the passes again, as they've not done since the Battle of Three Princes.
There was an undertone of sorrow in his voice. When Prince Roland was killed, I said, remembering, the Dauphin was one of the three princes.
Yes, Delaunay pushed the map away brusquely. And the other two?
The king's brother Benedict and, I struggled to recall, Percy of Lagnas, Comte de Somerville, cousin germain to Prince Roland, Alcuin's soft voice supplied. He pushed his white hair from his eyes and smiled. Kinsman on his mother's side to Queen Genevieve, which made him a prince of the blood in accordance with matrimonial law, though he seldom claims the title.
I glowered at him.
I knew that.
He shrugged and gave his inarguable smile.
Bide your peace.
There was no jest in Delaunay's tone, and his gaze was somber.
We paid dear for that victory, when it cost Roland de la Courcelle's life. He was born to rule, and would have held the throne with strength and grace upon his father's passing, and none would have dared take up arms against him. We have paid for the security of our borders with instability in the city itself, and now our gains stand threatened in the bargain.
Pushing himself away from the table, he rose to pace the library, standing at last to gaze silently out a window onto the streets below. Alcuin and I exchanged wordless glances. Delaunay was in many ways the gentlest of masters, reprimanding us with nothing harsher than an unkind word, and that only when we were truly deserving. But there was a darkness in him that surfaced only sometimes, and we who attended his moods closer than a farmer watches the weather knew well enough not to rouse it.
"Were you there, my lord?" I ventured at length.
He answered without turning around, and his voice was flat.
"If I could have saved his life, I would have. We shouldn't have been mounted, that was the problem. The ground was too uncertain. But Roland was always rash. It was his only flaw as a leader. When he led the third charge, he got too far ahead. His standard-bearer's horse stumbled and went down, and we were held back in getting around him. Not long, but long enough for the Skaldi to cut him off."
He turned back to us with that same somber look.
"On such small things empires may hang. For want of a sure-footed mount, half the scions of Elawa have their gaze set on becoming prince consort and claiming the throne through marriage. And princes of the blood, like Baudouin de Trevelyan, scheme to take it by force of acclaim. Remember it, my dears, and when you plan, plan well and thoroughly."
"You think Prince Baudouin wants the throne?" I asked, startled.
After more than 3 years, I still found myself struggling to grasp the shape of these patterns Delaunay studied. Alcuin looked unsurprised.
No, not exactly, Delaunay smiled wryly. But he is the king's nephew, and I think his mother, who is called for good reason the Lioness of Azal, would like to see her son seated upon it.
Ah. I blinked, and at last this pattern, Baudouin's actions, Delaunay's presence at the Midwinter Masque, came clear to me. My lord, what has that to do with Scaldic raiders on the eastern border?
Who knows, he shrugged. Nothing, perhaps. But there is no saying how events in one place may affect what happens elsewhere, for the tapestry of history is woven of many threads. We needs must study the whole warp and weft of it to predict the pattern on the loom.
Will the Scaldi invade? Alcuin asked softly, a distant glimmer of fear in his dark eyes. Delaunay smiled kindly and stroked his hair.
No, he said with certainty. They are as unorganized as the tribes of Alba before Kinil Rhu, and lords such as the Comte de Ferraud and Duke Maslin d'Aiglemore hold the passes well defended. They have built their strength since the Battle of Three Princes, that such may never occur again. But it is something to note, my dears, and you know what we say about that.
All knowledge is worth having. I knew it by rote. If Delaunay had a motto, that was surely it.
Indeed.
He turned his smile on me, and my heart leapt at his approval.
Go on and entertain yourselves. You've earned a respite, he added, dismissing us.
We went, obedient to his words, though reluctant always to be denied his presence. For those who never knew him, I can say only that there was a charm about Delaunay that compelled the affections of all who surrounded him.
For good or for ill, I might add, for I knew later some who despised him.
But those who hated him were the sort who envied excellence in others. No matter what he did, Anarfiel Delaunay did it with a grace that eludes most people in this world. A panderer, his detractors called him, and later the whoremaster of spies. But I knew him better than most, and never did he conduct himself with less than perfect nobility.
Which is part of what made him such a mystery.
It's not his real name, Hyacinth informed me.
How do you know?
He flashed me his white grin, vivid in the dim light. I've been asking. He thumped his slender chest. I wanted to know about the man who took you away from me.
I came back, I said mildly.
Delaunay, to my great annoyance, had been amused. My first escape had been planned with much forethought, executed while he was away at court, by climbing out a second-story window, disguised in boy's clothes, purloined from Alcuin's wardrobe. I had studied a map of the city and made my way on foot, alone and unaided, all the way to Knight's doorstep. It had been a tremendous reunion. We stole tarts from the pastry vendor in the marketplace for old time's sake, running all the way to Tertius Crossing, to crouch under the bridge and eat them, still warm, juices dripping down our chins. Afterward, Hyacinth had taken me to an inn, where he was known to the travelling players who lodged there, strutting about and making himself important by knowing bits of gossip this one or that would pay to hear. Players are notorious for their intrigues, worse even than adepts of the night court. Filled with the thrill of my adventure and the edge of anticipatory dread of its repercussions, I scarce noticed when a boy of some 8 or 9 years wormed his way through the throng to whisper in Hyacinth's ear. For the first time, I saw my friend frown.
"He says a man in livery sent him," Hyacinth said to me, "brown and gold with a sheaf of corn on the crest."
"Delaunay," I gasped. My chest contracted with fear. "Those are his colours."
Hyacinth looked irritated. "Well, his man is outside with a coach. He said to send Ardeal when you're ready to go." The boy nodded vigorously, and thus did I learn that Hyacinth had begun to create his own small net of messengers and errand-runners in Knight's doorstep, and that Anarfiel Delaunay not only knew that I had gone and where I had gone, but who Hyacinth was and what he was doing.
Delaunay never ceased to amaze. When I returned, he was waiting.
"I am not going to punish you," he said without preamble.
I don't know what expression I bore, but it seemed to entertain him. He pointed to a chair across from him.
"Come in, Fedra. Sit."
Once I had, he rose, pacing about the room.
Lamplight gleamed on his russet hair, bound in the sleek braid that showed off the noble lines of his face.
"Did you think I didn't know about your penchant for escape?" he asked, stopping in front of me.
I shook my head.
"It is my business to know things, and that most certainly includes things about members of my household. What the Dalwain preferred to conceal, my sweet, the members of her guard did not."
"I'm sorry, my lord," I cried, guilt-stricken.
He glanced at me with amusement and sat back down.
"Only in so far as you enjoy being sorry, my dear, which, while it is a considerable amount, occurs only after the fact, thus making it a singularly ineffective deterrent, yes?"
Confused, I nodded. Delaunay sighed and crossed his legs, his expression turning serious.
"Fedra, I don't object to your ambitious young friend. Indeed, you may well learn things in that quarter you'd not hear elsewhere. And,"
a flicker of amusement returned, "to a certain degree I don't object to your penchant for escape. And," leaning forward to pluck at the sleeve of Alcuin's tunic, which I wore, "disguise.
But there are dangers for a child alone in the city, to which I cannot have you exposed. Henceforth, if you wish, in your free time to visit your friend, you will inform Guy."
I waited for more. "That's all?"
"That's all."
I thought it through. A man who spoke softly and seldom, Guy served Delaunay with intense loyalty and efficiency in a variety of unnamed capacities.
"He'll follow me," I said finally, "or have me followed."
Delaunay smiled.
"Very good. You're welcome to try to detect and evade him, with my blessing. If you can do that, Fedra, I've no need to worry about you on your own. But you will inform him if you leave these grounds for any reason."
His complacency was maddening. "And if I don't?" I asked, challenging him with a toss of my head. The change that came over his face frightened me, truly frightened me, without a single tremor of excitement. His eyes turned cold, and the lines of his face set.
"I am not of Kushiel's line, Fedra. I do not play games of defiance and punishment. And as I care for you, I will not allow you to endanger yourself for a childish whim. I don't demand unquestioning obedience, but I demand obedience nonetheless. If you cannot give it, I will sell your mark."
With that ringing in my ears, you may be sure I paid heed. I saw his eyes. I had no doubt that he meant his words, which meant, of course, that as I sat with Hyacinth in his mother's kitchen, somewhere nearby, quiet and efficient, Guy kept watch.
"What is it, then?" I asked Hyacinth now. "Who is he, really?"
He shook his head, black ringlets swinging.
"That I don't know, but there is something I do know."
He grinned, baiting me. "I know why his poetry was banned."
"Why?"
I was impatient to know. In the corner where she muttered over the stove, Hyacinth's mother turned and glanced uneasily at us.
"Do you know how Prince Roland's first betrothed died?" he asked.
"It had happened before we were born, but thanks to Delaunay's ceaseless teachings, I was well versed in the history of the royal family."
"She broke her neck in a fall," I said. "A hunting accident."
"So they say," he said. "But after Roland wed Isabelle Lanvert, a song came to be heard in the stews and wine shops about a noble lady who seduced a stable boy and bid him to cut the girth on her rival's saddle the day she went a-hunting with her love."
"Delaunay wrote it? Why?"
Hyacinth shrugged.
"Who knows? This is what I heard. The men-at-arms of the princess consort caught the troubadour who was spreading the song. When she had him interrogated, he named Delaunay as the author of the lyrics. The troubadour was banished to Isande, and it is said that he died mysteriously en route. She brought Delaunay in for questioning, but he refused to confess to authorship. So he was not banished, but to appease his daughter-in-law, the king banned his poetry and had every extant copy of his work destroyed.
Then he is an enemy of the crown, I marvelled.
No, Hyacinth shook his head with certainty. If he were, he would surely have been banished, confession or no. The princess consort willed it, but he is still welcome at court. Someone protected him in this matter.
How did you learn this?
Oh, that. His grin flashed again. There is a certain court poet who conceives a hopeless passion for the wife of a certain innkeeper, whom he addresses in his rhymes as the Angel of Night's Door. She pays me in coin to tell him to go away and bother her no more, and he pays me, in tales, to tell him how she looked when she said it. I will learn for you what I can, Phaedra.
You will learn it to your despair.
The words were spoken darkly, and I thought, to Hyacinth. But when I looked, I saw his mother's arm extended, pointing at me. A dire portent gleamed in her hollow, shadowed eyes, the dusky, weathered beauty of her face framed in dangling gold.
I do not understand, I said, confused.
You seek to unravel the mystery of your master.
She jabbed her pointing finger at me.
You think it is for curiosity's sake, but I tell you this. You will rue the day all is made clear. Do not seek to hasten its coming.
With that she turned back to her stove, ignoring us. I looked at Hyacinth. The mischief had left his expression. He respected very little, but his mother's gift of Dromond was among those few things. When she told fortunes for the denizens of Night's Doorstep, she made shift to use an ancient, tattered pack of cards. But I knew from what he had told me that this was only for show. Dromond came when bidden, and sometimes when not. The second sight that parted the veils of time.
We considered her warning in silence. Delaunay's words came unbidden to mind. All knowledge is worth having, I said. Chapter 9. By the end of my fourth year of my service to Anarfiel Delaunay, I had come of age. In the Night Court I would have been initiated into the mysteries of Nama, and begun the training of my apprenticeship when I turned 13. Delaunay, infuriatingly, had chosen to wait. I thought I would die of impatience before he posed me the question, although I did not.
"You have grown from a child to a young woman, Phaedra," he said. "May the blessing of Nama be upon you."
He took my shoulders in his hands then, and looked gravely at me.
"I am going to ask you a question now, and I swear by Blessed Eloa, I want you to answer it freely. Will you do it?"
"Yes, my lord." His topaz-flecked eyes searched mine.
"Is it your will to be dedicated unto the service of Nama?"
I held off giving an answer, glad of a chance to gaze at such leisure at his beloved face, elegant and austere. His hands on my shoulders, I wished he would touch me more often. "Yes, my lord," I said at last, making my voice sound firm and resolute.
As if there were any question. But of course Delaunay had to satisfy his sense of honour. Because I adored him, I understood. "Good."
He squeezed my shoulders once and released me, smiling. Faint lines crinkled at the corners of his eyes. Like the rest of him, they were beautiful.
"We'll buy a dove in the marketplace, and take you to the temple to be dedicated."
If I had felt cheated of ceremony upon my 10th birthday, this day compensated for it. Clapping his hands, Delaunay called for the mistress of the household and gave orders for a feast to be prepared. Lessons were dismissed for the day, and Alcuin and I were sent away to dress in our best festival attire.
"I'm glad,"
Alcuin whispered to me, grasping my hand and giving me his secret smile. He had turned 14 earlier that year and been dedicated to Nama. Still a child, by Delaunay's reckoning, I had been excluded from the rites.
"So am I," I whispered back, leaning over to kiss his cheek.
Alcuin blushed, the colour rising becomingly beneath his fair skin. "Come on," he said, pulling away. "He's waiting." In the marketplace we strolled among the temple vendors while the carriage waited patiently and Delaunay made a show of allowing me to choose the exact right dove for my offering. They were much alike, as birds are wont to be, but I studied them carefully and selected at length a beautiful white bird with coral feet and alert black eyes. Delaunay paid the vendor, purchasing the best cage, a charming pagoda with gilt bars. The dove struggled a little as the vendor transferred her, wings beating at the bars. A good sign, as it meant she was healthy. In the night court, the dedication is performed in the house temple. But under the patronage of a noble citizen, we went to the great temple. It is a small, lovely building of white marble, surrounded by gardens. Doves roosted in the trees, sacred and unharmed. An acolyte met us at the open doors. Taking one look at Delaunay, she bowed. "In the name of Nama, you are welcome, my lord. How may we serve you?" I stood beside him, clutching the carrying handle of the birdcage. Delaunay laid his hand upon my head.
"She is here to be dedicated to the service of Nama."
The acolyte smiled at me. She was young, no more than 18, with a look of spring about her. Red-gold hair, the colour of apricots, and green eyes that tilted upward at the corners like a cat's. Young as she was, she wore the flowing scarlet surplice of the priesthood of Nama, with an ease born of long familiarity. By this, I would guess, she had been dedicated as an infant, by parents or a mother who could not afford to raise her. By her speech, I would guess she was city-born. "So," the acolyte said softly, "be welcome, sister." Stooping only slightly, she was little taller than I, she kissed me in greeting. Her lips were soft, and she smelled of sun-warmed herbs. When she turned to kiss Alcuin, they were of a height. "Be welcome, brother." Stepping back, she gestured us through the door. "Come in and worship. I will bring the priest." Inside, the temple was filled with sunlight, adorned only by flowers and a blaze of candles. There was an oculus at the top of the dome, open to the sky. We approached the altar with its magnificent statue of Nama, who stood with arms open, welcoming all worshippers. I set down the birdcage, knelt and gazed at her face, which radiated compassion and desire. Delaunay knelt too, grave and respectful, while Alcuin's expression was rapt. When the priest emerged, attended by four acolytes, ours among them, he was tall and slender, handsome in his age, with fine lines engraving his face and silver hair bound in a long braid. He indicated that we should stand.
"Is it your wish to be dedicated to the service of Nama?"
he asked me, his voice solemn. "It is." Beckoning me forward, he pushed back his scarlet sleeves. One acolyte held a basin of water, and the priest dipped an aspergillum into the bowl and sprinkled a few drops over me.
"By Nama's sacred river, I baptize you into her service."
Taking honey cake from another, he broke it open and placed a portion on my tongue.
"May your flesh be bound unto the sweetness of desire," he said.
I chewed and swallowed, tasting honey. The green-eyed acolyte handed him a chalice, which he held to my lips.
"May your blood rise to the headiness of passion."
The last acolyte held up a measure of oil, and the priest dipped his fingers into it. Smearing chrism on my brow, he held my eyes.
"May your soul ever find grace in the service of Nama,"
he intoned softly. I could feel his fingertip cool on my skin beneath the oil and the power vested in him. Nama's face, transcendent and sensuous, swam before my eyes. I closed them and felt the air of the temple beating about me, filled with light and wings and celestial magics. All the stories of Nama I had heard, told in all the 13 houses, all of them were true and none. She was all of that and more.
"So mote it be," said the priest,
and I opened my eyes.
he and the acolytes had withdrawn. He nodded at me.
"You may offer your service, my child."
Alcuin held the birdcage for me. I opened it carefully and caught the dove in both hands, removing her. Whiter than snow, she weighed almost nothing in my hands, but I could feel the warm life pulsing in her, the fast, frightened heartbeat. Her feathers were soft, and when she stirred, I feared the gentle pressure of my hands would break fragile bones. Turning back to the altar, I knelt once more and held the dove up to the statue of Nama. "Blessed Nama, I beg you to accept my service," I said, whispering without knowing why. I opened my hands. Startled into freedom, the dove launched itself into the air, pinions churning in the sunlight. Certain and unerring, she flew up to the apex of the dome, circling once, then spiraling in a flurry of sun-edged white feathers out the oculus, into flight and the open skies. The priest tracked her progress with a smile.
"Welcome," he said,
bending to aid me to my feet and giving me the kiss of greeting. His eyes, tranquil with peace and the wisdom of a thousand trysts, looked kindly at me.
"Welcome, servant of Nama."
Thus was I dedicated to the life unto which I was born. In the following week, my training began. Delaunay had held off initiating Alcuin into the training proper to a servant of Nama, waiting so that we might begin together, being so close in age. Our training, it seemed, was to commence simultaneously.
"I have arranged for a showing," he said evenly, having summoned us to attend him. "It is not proper that you should study the mysteries of Nama without one. Edmond Nuault, the Darwain of Camellia House, has honored my request."
It was so like Delaunay, his subtle tact, to make arrangements with the house to which I had no ties, to avoid evoking memories of my childhood in the night court. I didn't bother to tell him. I wouldn't have minded. It would have spoiled the gift of his kindness. While there are a myriad variations of pairings and pleasures, the showing staged for a newly dedicated servant of Nama is always the traditional pairing. One man, one woman. Guy drove us to Camellia House that evening. I was surprised to find it even more punctilious than serious, though I shouldn't have been. The canon of Camellia is perfection, and they adhere to it in strict detail. We were met at the door by the Darwain second, a stunning tall woman with a long fall of black hair and skin the colour of new ivory. She greeted us gracefully, and if there was envy or curiosity in the way her gaze lingered on Alcuin's unlikely beauty, or the unexpected scarlet mote in my eye, it was well disguised. "Come," she said, beckoning us. "As you have been dedicated to the service of Nama, come witness her mysteries enacted." The showing chamber was much like the one at Sirius House, a three-quarter round, sunken stage strewn with cushions and encircled with tiers of well-padded benches. There was a gauze curtain drawn about the stage, lit from within, and I could make out behind it the velvet hangings concealing the entrance. It is a rule of all the 13 houses that any ritual showing be open to all adepts of the house, so I was not surprised when others entered. A private titillation is another matter, but the rites of Nama are open to all her servants. I fell into habit, without a trace of forethought, kneeling on the cushions in the prescribed position. Abbe Aunt, head bowed, hands clasped before me. It was strangely comforting, although I sensed Alcuin's sidelong glance as he attempted to mimic my pose. Somewhere in the background, a flautist began to play. On the commencement of the second musical passage, the velvet hangings rustled, and the pair entered. He was tall and black-haired, a veritable twin. He was indeed her brother, to the second of Camellia House. She stood a hand's breadth shorter than he, even paler of skin, with hair like an autumn tumbril. There is no canon save perfection in this house. When they faced each other and reached out to perform the disrobement, it was evident, even through veils of gauze, that both amply met the standards of their canon.
Their joining was like a dance. He touched her with reverence, fingertips resting at the sides of her waist, drawing them up in a delicate caress and lifting the glorious weight of her hair, letting it flow over his hands and fall back in a shining mass. His hands caressed her face, tracing the feathery arch of her brows, the perfect line of her lips. She cupped the angle of his jaw, drew a line down the muscular column of his throat, and flattened her palm against the pale planes of his breast. The gifts of Nama are born in the blood and belong to all of us by right, but one need not be an artist to enjoy art. These were adepts of the Night Court, and this was their art. As the arousement proceeded, the gauze veils were drawn back slowly, one by one. I watched raptly, and my breath came quickly, when I did not hold it in suspense. They embraced and kissed. He held her face in his hands as if it were a precious object, and she swayed like a willow into his kiss. This is how we pray, who are servants of Nama. Breaking the kiss, she knelt before him and flung her hair forward so it cascaded about his loins, silken tendrils twining about his erect phallus. I could not see how her mouth moved as she performed Volongi's Ma upon him, but his face grew tranquil with pleasure, and I could see the muscles grow taut in his buttocks. Reaching behind his head with both hands, he undid his braid and shook out his hair, which fell in a black river of silk over his shoulders. There was no sound from those assembled, only a reverent silence drawn tight by the sweet notes of the flautist. He drew away to kneel opposite her, and she reclined slowly on the cushions, opening her legs to him to share her wealth. Now it was his hair that hid them from my sight, spread like a black curtain across her thighs as he parted her cleft with his tongue, seeking the pearl of Nama hidden in her folds. It must be that he found it, for she arched with pleasure, reaching up to draw him to her. He held himself above her, the tip of his phallus poised at her entrance. His hair spilled down around his bowed head and mingled with hers, black and russet. I had never seen anything so beautiful as their lovemaking. The flautist paused. Someone cried out, and he entered her in one fluid surge, sheathing himself to the hilt. A soft, whispering drumbeat entered the song as he thrust, her body rising to receive him. Still kneeling, hands clasped tight together, I found myself weeping at the beauty of it. They were like birds who mate on the wing. It was a ritual and no mere spectacle. I could taste the worship and desire of it, flooding my mouth like the priest's honey. He surged against her like waves breaking, and she met him like the rising tide. Their pace increased, and the music rose to a crescendo, until she gasped, hands clenching against the working muscles of his back, her legs wrapped around him. He arched back then and held hard. I could feel the heat rising between my own thighs as they met their climax together. And then, too soon, the gauze curtains began slowly to close, veiling their figures in the soft aftermath of desire. I saw him move to her side, and their hands clasped as they lay entwined upon the cushions. At my own side, Alcuin released a long-held breath, and we looked soberly at one another. Presently an adept came to lead us to a sitting room, where we were served a restorative cordial and attended by the second of Camellia House, who graciously expressed her hopes that the showing had been well received and that we would communicate our good impressions to our master, Anarfiel de Launay, who still held the power to set trends in the royal court. If she resented or despised us for enjoying his patronage, I could not tell it.
Chapter 10. With good reason, I supposed that after the showing, we would begin our formal training in the arts of Nama. And so we were, but not at all as I had imagined. De Launay contracted an instructor, the finest instructor one could have in the arts, to be sure. What I hadn't reckoned on was the fact that she was well into her 50s, and all our learning took place in the classroom and not the bedchamber. In her prime, Cecily Lavaux-Perrin had been an adept of Sirius House. Indeed, she had trained under my old mistress, the Dowane. She was one of the few who had attained the pinnacle of success for a member of the Night Court, attracting sufficient following among peers of the realm that she was able to set up her own household upon making her mark. For 7 years she was the toast of royalty. Peers and poets flocked to her gatherings, and she held her own court, bestowing the favour of her bedchamber at her own choosing, or not at all. Ultimately she chose to wed, and retired from the Haute Demi-Monde. Her choice fell upon Antoine Perrin, Chevalier of the Order of the Swan, a calm and steadfast man who had left his country estates to serve as a military consultant to the king. They lived quietly, entertaining seldom and on a wholly intellectual level. After his untimely death, she maintained this lifestyle. Delaunay, it seemed, was one of few people who knew her from both worlds. I knew all of this because I eavesdropped upon their meeting when she agreed to take on our instruction. It is not a noble undertaking, but I felt no guilt in it. It was what I was trained to do. Delaunay had taught us, garner knowledge by any means possible. There was a storeroom off the courtyard where herbs from the garden were hung to dry. If one were small enough, there was space between a cabinet and an open window where one could crouch and overhear almost any conversation taking place in the courtyard. And when the pleasantries were done, Delaunay made his request. Her voice had retained all its charm, even and mellifluous. I could still hear it in the faint cadences of Sirius House, the attentive pauses, a merest hint of breathiness, but I doubt it would have been evident to an untrained ear. Years of reserve had tempered it. "What you ask is impossible, Anna Fiel." I heard a rustle. She shook her head. "You know I have been long retired from the service of Namar."
"Do you take your pledge so lightly?" His voice countered hers smoothly. "I do not ask you to offer carnal instruction, Cecily, merely to teach. All the great texts, the Ecstatica, the Journey of Namar, the 3000 Joies.
"Would you have me teach the boy Antinous's ode to his beloved?" Her voice was light, but I heard for the first time steel in it.
"No,"
Delaunay's reply was explosive. When he spoke again, I could tell it was from a different location. He had risen, then pacing. His voice was under control now, and his tone was dry.
"To speak that poem aloud is proscribed, Cecily. You know better than that."
"Yes," she offered the word simply, with no apology. "Why are you doing this?"
"You have to ask who was the greatest courtesan of our age."
He was too charming. It was not often I heard Delaunay being evasive. She would have none of it.
"That's not what I meant."
Why?
His voice was moving. He was pacing again.
"Why? I will tell you. Because there are places I cannot go, and people I cannot reach, Cecily. In the Court of Chancery, the Exchequer, secretaries with access to the Privy Seal, everywhere the actual business of governing the realm takes place, Isabel's allies bar their doors to me. They cannot be swayed, Cecily, but they can be seduced. I know their vices. I know their desires. I know how to reach them."
"That much I know."
Her tone was gentle, moderating his. "I have known you for a long time. You've taken me into your confidence, and I know how you think. What I am asking you, Anna Fiel, is why. Why do you do this?" There was a long pause, and my muscles began to ache with the strain of crouching in that cramped space. No wind was stirring, and the close air of the storeroom was sweet and pungent with the scents of rosemary and lavender.
"You know why."
It was all he said. I bit my tongue to keep from urging her to question him further, but whatever he meant by it, she understood. She had, as she said, known him a very long time.
Still, she asked kindly, and then, ah, but you made a promise.
All right, then, I will honor it too, Anarfiel, for what it is worth. I will instruct your pupils in the great texts of love, those that are not prescribed, and I will lecture them on the arts of Nama. If you swear to me that both have entered this service of their own desire, this much I will do.
I swear it. There was relief in his voice.
How much do they know?
Enough. He grew reserved. Enough to know what they are about. Not enough to get them killed.
Isabelle Lanvers is dead, Anarfiel. She spoke softly, the way one does to a child who fears the darkness. Do you truly think her grudge lives beyond the grave?
It lives in those who obeyed her, he said grimly.
Isabelle Lanvers de la Courcelle was my enemy, but we knew where we stood with one another. We might even have become allies when Roland's daughter was old enough to take the throne. Now all is changed.
I heard a faint clink as the lip of the wine jug touched the rim of a glass. Marcelin d'Aiglemore's wound turned septic. He died 2 days ago, did you hear? Isidore will be sworn in as Duke d'Aiglemore in a fortnight, and he's petitioned the king for another 500 retainers.
He'll have his hands full holding the border.
True. The undertones of Sirius House had given way to a pensive edge in her voice. Nonetheless, he found time to visit Namar and pay tribute to Melisande Charizai at her country house there. Now Melisande is seen in the company of Prince Baudouin, and it is said the Lioness of Azal is displeased.
Melisande Charizai collects hearts as the royal gardener collects seedlings, Delaunay said dismissively. Gaspar says Mark will have a word with his son, if it becomes needful.
Another soft clink, a glass being replaced on one of the low-tiled tables. I had learned to discern such distinctions, even with the crick in my neck.
Perhaps.
But don't underestimate either of them.
The Charizai or the Lioness.
I do not think they make that mistake with each other.
And after all, the failure to understand women has been your downfall, Anarfiel.
I heard the swishing sound of her garments as she rose. I will come in the morning, and the children's education will commence. Good night, my dear. I listened to the sounds of their leaving, then squirmed out of my confinement, racing upstairs to tell Alcuin what I had learned. And, of course, to speculate on what it all meant. By light of day, Cecily Lavaux-Perrin was tall and slender, with fine bones and pale blue eyes, the colour of a new-opened lobelia. It is a funny thing with adepts of Sirius House, how the underlying steel is revealed in those who do not wither and fade. In this, she reminded me of the Dalwain, but she was younger and kinder. Still, she was a harsh taskmistress, and set us to read and memorize the first of the great texts of which Delaunay had spoken. For Alcuin it was a revelation. I had not understood fully, when we witnessed the showing, the depth of his naivete. Astonishing though it seemed to me, he had no comprehension of the mechanics of the deeds by which one offers homage to Nama. I, who had never entered the dance, nonetheless knew the steps by heart. Alcuin had only the instincts of his gentle heart and eager flesh, such as any peasant in the field might have. Later I understood that this was part of his charm, as Delaunay meant it to be. The unspoiled sweetness that was ever a part of Alcuin was part and parcel of his charm, and irresistibly seductive to the over-sophisticated palate. But then I did not understand. I would watch him in the evenings when we studied together, reading with lips parted and wonder suffusing his features. "The caress of winnowed chaff," he would read, murmuring. "Place your hands on the waist of your beloved, drawing them upward slowly, gathering and lifting your beloved's hair so that it floats like chaff above the threshing floor, letting it fall like soft rain." Did you know that, Fedra? Yes, I gazed into his wide dark eyes. They did that at the showing, remember? I had known these things since I was a child, had grown up learning them. It was slowly and surely driving me mad not to practice any of them. I remember. The caress of the summer wind. He read the directions aloud, shaking his head in amazement. Does that really work? I'll show you. If I knew no more than he in practice, I at least had seen these things done. I led him to the floor where we knelt facing each other. His features were grave and uncertain. I placed my fingertips lightly on the crown of his head, barely touching his milk-white hair, then drew them slowly down. Down the silken fall of his hair, over his shoulders, down his slender arms. My heart beat quickened as I did it, and a strange certainty rose in my blood. I was scarce touching him, fingertips hovering above his pale skin, but where they passed, the fine hair rose on his arms like a wheat field stirred by the summer wind. See? Oh! Alcuin drew back, gazing in awe at his skin, shivered into goose flesh with subtle pleasure. You know so much. You are better than I at the things which matter to Delaunay, I said shortly. It was true. As much as I had learned, I could not match the quicksilver facility with which Alcuin observed and recorded. He could remember whole conversations and relate them in their entirety, right down to the speaker's intonations. Alcuin, I changed my own tone, putting on the murmurous, beguiling inflections of Sirius House, but I heard underlying Cecily's voice. We could practice, if you like. It would help us both to learn. Alcuin shook his head, with the susurrus of moonlight-coloured hair, wide eyes ingenuous. Delaunay doesn't want us to, Phaedra. You know that. It was true. Delaunay had made it explicit, and not even the lore of gathered knowledge was enough to tempt Alcuin to disobedience. With a sigh, I returned to my books. But of course there was nothing to prevent me from practicing on myself. It began that night in the darkness of my little room, which I had all to myself. We were studying the opening caresses of arousement. Throwing off my coverlet to lie naked on my bed, I whispered their names to myself, tracing their patterns on my skin, until my blood burned beneath the touch of my fingers. And yet I refrained from seeking the release I knew was to be gained, adhering strictly to the lessons we were allotted. I cannot say why, save that it was a torment, and as such was sweet to me. Older and wiser than Delaunay in the service of Narmar, Cecily Lavaux-Perrin discerned my predicament. We were reciting Emmeline of Isarne's Log of 700 Kisses, most of which I was unable to practice by myself, when I felt her shrewd gaze resting upon me and faltered. "You are impatient with these studies, no?" she asked me. "No, my lady." Long trained to obedience, my reply was automatic. I raised my eyes to meet her gaze and swallowed. "My lady, I was raised in the Night Court. Had I been allowed to stay, my training would have begun a year gone by. Even now I might be saving toward my mark, perhaps even paying the markist to limb the base, if my virgin price were high enough. Yes, I am impatient." "So it is money that is the spur which goads you, hm?" She stroked my hair, smiling a little. "No," I admitted it softly, leaning into her touch. "It is Kushiel's dart which pricks you, then." She waited until I looked up again, nodding, not a little surprised. She had never spoken of it, and no one in Sirius House had known me for what I was. Cecily laughed. "Anafiel Delaunay is not the only scholar in the world, my sweet, and I have done a fair amount of reading since I left the Court of Night-Blooming Flowers. Never fear. I'll keep Anafiel's secret until he's ready to reveal you. But until that time, there is naught you can do but suffer the torments of your own devising." A flush of embarrassment suffused my skin. "There is no fulfilment that is not made sweeter for the prolonging of desire,"
She patted my burning cheek. If you wish to improve your skill, use a mirror and a candle, that you may see what you're about and study the lineaments of desire. That night, I did. By candlelight I traced the patterns of arousal upon my skin, watching it change and blush, and thought about the fact that Cecily knew, and Alcuin, and wondered in a delicious frisson of guilt and shame if either had told Delaunay what I did in secret. So did my education continue. Chapter 11. In the 2 years that followed, we did nothing but study until I thought I should die of it. And to make matters worse, Hyacinth, my one true friend, was no help at all. "I cannot touch you, Phaedra," he said with regret, shaking his black ringlets. We sat in the Cockerel, an inn which he had made his informal headquarters. "Not in that way. I am Tsingano, and you're an indentured servant. It is Vrajna, forbidden, according to the laws of my people." I opened my mouth to reply, but before I could speak, a giggling young noblewoman detached herself from a party of revellers occupying the long table at the centre of the inn. It was the fashion among daring young lords and ladies to gallivant about knight's doorstep in groups of 7 or 8, hoisting tankards and rubbing elbows with poets, players, and commoners. Hyacinth had become something of a fashion, too. "Oh, Prince of Travellers," she began solemnly, then giggled and cast a glance at her laughing friends, getting the rest of the words out with difficulty. "Oh, oh, Prince of Travellers, if I cross your palm with gold, will you read the fortune written mine?" At the gleam of a gold coin, Hyacinth, who had never to my knowledge ventured past Knight's doorstep, put on his best Prince of Travellers manner, rising to give her a graceful bow, his dark eyes mirthful. "Star of the evening," he said, at once wheedling and portentous, "I am at your command. For one coin, one answer, as scribed by the fates upon your fair palm. What would you know, gracious lady?" Deliberately ignoring me, she arranged her skirts and sat rather closer to Hyacinth than was necessary. She gave him her hand with the air of someone bestowing great favour, then whispered, "I wish to know if Ren Lasseur will take me to wife." Hyacinth gazed intently at her palm. She stared at his bowed head. I could see the rapid, shallow breaths she took, heaving her bosom, upon which she sported a daringly low décolletage beneath a daringly costly filigree necklace. Across the inn her friends clustered and watched. The young lords surrounded one of their number, jabbing him with pointed elbows and laughing. He bore it with crossed arms, and a hint of displeasure flared his nostrils. One of the young noblewomen smiled, secretive and self-possessed. It needed no touch of Drummond to answer her question, but Hyacinth answered without looking, shaking his head. "Fair lady, the answer is no. Nuptials, I see, not now, but 3 years hence, and a chateau with 3 towers standing, and one that crumbles."
"The Comte de Tour Perdu!"
Snatching her hand back, she covered her mouth. Her eyes shone. "Oh, oh!" She reached out then and laid her fingers on her lips. "Oh, my mother will be joyed to hear it. You must tell no one of this. Swear it." Quick and graceful, Hyacinth grasped her silencing fingers in his own and kissed them. "Sovereign lady, I am more discreet than the dead. May you be joyous and prosper." Fumbling in the purse that hung from her girdle, she passed him another coin.
"Thank you. Oh, thank you. Remember, not a word."
He rose to bow again as she hurried back to join her friends, babbling some heady nonsense to disguise her sudden fortune. Hyacinth sat back down and made her coins disappear, looking pleased with himself.
"Was it true?" I asked him.
"Who knows?" he shrugged. "I saw what I saw. There is more than one chateau with a broken tower. She believes as she wishes."
It was no concern of mine if Hyacinth sold dreams and half-truths to preening peers, but something else did concern me.
You know, Delaunay has a scroll by a scholar who travelled with the company of Tsingani and documented their customs. He says it is Vrajna for a Tsingano man to attempt the Dromond, Hyacinth. Worse than anything, worse than mingling with a Garja servant. What your mother teaches you is forbidden. And you cannot be a true Tsingano anyway, not with pure Dangeline blood on one side. Your mother was cast out of the company for that, wasn't she? I spoke recklessly, driven to it by my thwarted desires and the annoyance of watching him cater to simpering noblewomen. This time perhaps I had gone too far. His eyes flashed proud and angry. You speak where you have no knowledge and no right. My mother is a princess of the Tsingani, and the gift of Dromond is mine by right of blood. What would your Delaunay's Garja scholar know of that? Enough to know that Tsingani princesses do not take in washing for a living, I shot back. Unexpectedly, Hyacinth laughed. If he thinks that, then truly he learned little of the Tsingani. We have survived many centuries in any way we could. Anyway, I earn enough money now that she no longer need wash the clothes of others. He looked soberly at me, shrugging. Maybe it is a little bit true, what you say. I do not know. When I am old enough, I will seek out my mother's people. But until then, I must trust her words. I know enough of her gift to know I dare not defy it. Or you're afraid of Delaunay, I grumbled. I'm afraid of no one. He looked so like the boy I had first known, puffing out his slender chest, but I too laughed, and our quarrel was forgotten.
Hey, Tsingano!
It was one of the young lordlings, drunk and arrogant. He swaggered up to our table, one hand hovering over the hilt of his rapier. He had cruel eyes and fine clothes. With a negligent gesture he tossed his purse on the table. It fell with a heavy clinking sound.
How much for a night with your sister?
I don't know what either of us would have answered. I was accustomed to venturing into night's doorstep, well cloaked, and we sat always in one of the darker corners, away from the hearth. Hyacinth was known and tolerated with no small affection, and the innkeep and regular patrons permitted him the small mystery of my visits without prying into my presence. All these things I thought at a flash, and on their heels came pleasure and pride that this lordling's gaze had penetrated the shadows and come to rest on me with desire. And hard upon that thought came a swell of excitement at the very prospect of selling myself from under Delaunay's nose and going with this stranger, whose blade-ready hands and careless offer promised the kind of hard usage I craved. In the space of a breath, I thought these things and saw Hyacinth eyeing the heavy purse. And then Delaunay's man Guy was there.
You cannot afford her virgin price, my friend.
His seldom-used voice was as mild as ever, but the point of his poniard rested below the lordling's chin, and I caught glimpse of a second dagger poised at belly level. I had not even seen him enter the inn. The lordling stood with upraised chin and glaring eyes, pricked by steel into humiliating attentiveness.
Go now, and rejoin your companions.
The calm voice and cold steel were more convincing than brawn and volume could ever have been. I watched the lordling swallow, all arrogance leaving him. He turned without a word and retraced his steps. Guy sheathed his dagger without comment.
We will leave now,
he said to me, puffing up the hood of my cloak and fastening it under my chin. I went obediently, able to spare only a quick wave of farewell in Hyacinth's direction, as Guy shepherded me out of the crowded inn. Hyacinth, who was used from our earliest acquaintance to abrupt and forceful departures on my part, took it with aplomb. For me it was a long coach ride home. I huddled silent in my cloak until finally Guy began to speak.
It is not always for us to choose.
It was dark in the carriage, and I could not see his face, only hear his flat voice.
My parents gave me to be reared by the Castline Brotherhood when I was but a babe, Fedra, and the Brotherhood cast me out when I was 14 and broke my oath with a farmer's daughter. I made my way to the city and fell into a life of crime. Though I was good at it, I despised myself and wished to die. One day when I thought I could fall no lower, I took a commission from an agent of someone very powerful to assassinate a nobleman on his way home from a party.
"Delaunay," I gasped, astonished. Guy ignored the interruption.
I resolved to succeed or die, but the nobleman disarmed me. I waited for the killing blow, but he asked me instead, "My friend, you fight like one trained by the Castellan Brotherhood. How is it, then, that you come to be engaged in this least fraternal of acts?" And upon his query, I began to weep.
I waited for more, but Guy fell silent a long while. There was no sound but the clopping hooves of the horses and the coachman's tuneless whistle.
"We do not choose our debts," he said at length, "but indebted we are, both of us, to Anarfiel Delaunay. Do not seek to betray him. Your debt may be discharged one day, but mine is unto the death, Fedra."
The night was chilly, and his words struck cold into my bones. I shivered in my thick cloak and thought about what he had said, wondering at the power in Delaunay to reach even a heart hardened by crime and despair. But if Guy was Delaunay's man unto death, he was not what I was, his pupil. The words of his speech, the most he'd ever spoken in my presence, fell into place in the vast puzzle in my mind, forming one important question. Who wanted Delaunay dead? In the darkness of the coach, I could feel him glance at me.
"Isabel de la Courcelle," came the flat reply. "The princess consort."